talk about the start of the American avant-garde, where it began. Now, Carol, have you touched on the work of Leo Ornstein at all?
A little bit.
Yes.
Not too much.
Yes. Leo Ornstein is actually a fascinating figure in American musical history. His name is O-R-N-S-T-E-I-N, Ornstein. And last night I was reading in the apartment where I was staying, there was a volume of tributes to Paul Rosenfeld. Do you know that name? I see you're very knowledgeable. Terrific. There aren't many people that know both Leo Ornstein and Paul Rosenfeld. And someone ought to hurry up and do something about Leo Ornstein, because Leo Ornstein is still alive. He's 93. And he lives in Green Bay, Wisconsin. It'd be a fascinating thing to do. Now, way back in 1916, when he was 19 years old, he wrote a piece called The Wild Man's Dance. And it is, I didn't want to bring it because it's a first edition. It's full of very thick tone clusters and extremely dissonant. It's an extraordinary work, and I don't know of anything else that was being done at the time, except Ives, but they didn't know each other. I don't know where Leo Ornstein got these ideas. He's an absolutely fabulous figure. I was speaking to Otto Luening, who was born at the turn of the century, the other day, and I said, what ever happened to Leo Ornstein? We reminisce about our pals. And said, well, he did this remarkable music, really dissonant clusters. It goes on and on. It's called The Wild Man's Dance. And he said, well, he evidently stopped composing, began teaching. He was a fabulous pianist. He started teaching piano in Philadelphia. He subsequently started to compose again. Do you know anything about his further history, Carol? Yes.
After the 20s, not too much.
No.
No, he composed through the 20s, and at some point he retired to Arizona or New Mexico or somewhere.
New Mexico, but then he's landed up in Green
Bay.
But he really is, I wish some doctoral candidate would do a piece on him before he gets much older, because he's a fascinating figure and I think a seminal figure for the avant-garde. He was very much alone then. Of course, I was 3 years old at the time, so I don't remember anything about Leo Ornstein from that time. I received an education as a traditional education as a pianist. I began it when I was 5, which is not too early for prodigies. I know prodigies that have played at 3, and there's one that played at 2. So 5 is late. And I received a traditional education, and I ended up at the age of 11 with a very interesting woman by the name of Diane Lavoie Hertz, who also was a great friend of Ruth Crawford and a great influence on Ruth Crawford. Her name is a hyphenated name, Lavoie-Hertz, Diane with a J, D-J-A-N-E. She had studied with Scriabin. I don't think Scriabin gave piano lessons, but she was with him, I believe, in Belgium, and he gave kind of master classes and probably held forth in a guru type seminar. But anyway, that was a direct connection with Scriabin. And this is important to know if you're interested in the works of Ruth Crawford, too, because this wasn't just a theoretical connection. It was a living connection with Scriabin. Now, this was, I began to study with her in 1924. And in a couple of years, she introduced me to the works of Scriabin. And very soon, I was playing the advanced works of Scriabin. If you study if you look at the works of Ruth Crawford, there's a very strong Scriabin influence. In the early works, not imitative, but an influence. Through her, I met also Dane Rudyard. Have you talked about him a little bit? And Shall I spell these names, or do they? He was my teacher. We called her Madame Hertz. Had been influenced by Scriabin's Eastern ideas. Her studio was full of Buddhas. I was awestruck, and as a child, seeing these Buddha figures. That's where you waited for your turn, for your lesson. And this is well before these things were cults in the United States, long, long before that. Of course, again, it was the theosophical ideas of Scriabin coming along. And Rudyard, as you know, was deeply influenced by Scriabin. So that was the start of my own exposure to contemporary music, first through the late works of Scriabin. Then Ruth Crawford used to play her pieces for me also. And I think Ruth would be very surprised to know she has become such an important figure in American music. She was very modest. When I was about 13, when I'd been studying with her about for a year and a half, I started when I was 12. My teacher, Madame Hertz, was very kindly made an arrangement with Ruth. The arrangement was that Ruth would give me harmony lessons, and in exchange for which Madame Hertz would give Ruth piano lessons, because my family didn't have enough money to pay for my lessons. So when I was about 12 and a half, Ruth said to me, I'd done some harmony. She wasn't a particularly good harmony teacher. If you consider a good harmony teacher a teacher like Boulanger, or later I studied with Sessions, that is not at all to her discredit that she was not a good harmony teacher. I myself, while I studied, went through the whole thing with Roger Sessions, and he was a superb teacher of harmony. I've never taught harmony as such myself. It takes a certain kind of analytic persistence, and also a belief in the tradition that both Boulanger and Roger Sessions had, that I'm afraid I don't have. But anyway, so that's to say that I'm not saying anything detrimental about Ruth Crawford if I say she wasn't. But she was an inspiring teacher of composition for me. And she asked me to write a piece just as part of my harmony studies. I'd never written music before. I was busy writing, you know, list pieces and all that. And I wrote a piece. And I tell you this story because little things, it's the little things that happen in your education, the quote little things, that make it make an enormous difference. I played the piece for her, and when I turned around to look at her, she was in the other end of the room. She had a very, very thoughtful look on her face. She had really listened to it. She had really listened. Well, it wasn't, she didn't say nice, you know, nice girl. She said, write a piece for next week. And that was the beginning of my addiction. It really got to be a totally absorbing thing, to the extent that Madame Hertz was rather unhappy that I wasn't practicing very much. I was composing. And also at this time, I'll throw in just a little bit about my other education, because it's not traditional. Oh, I preface my remarks about my general education by saying that I was a brilliant student in elementary school, as they called it then. I skipped two classes, and I was the head of the class of 150. But come high school, where there were 50 students in the class, I didn't like it. And my moment of enlightenment came when we studied something called social studies. What do you call them? Civics. Then we called it civics. You call it social studies now. No, you go to social studies, is that what it's called now? When you study, yes, it was called it civics. Well, we had to memorize the number of post offices in the United States. And I was just not quite 14. I said, I don't want to know that. And so I told my mother I didn't want to go to school anymore. I was a dropout. Is this very, am I doing bad things by telling you all that? And of course, high school now is very inspiring. It's very different than it was. It's you don't have, except you have more dropouts than they had. Anyway, my mother and father were very cooperative. I would spend my days practicing piano and composing 4 or 5 hours a day. It wasn't a problem at all. And my parents didn't, they were Russian Jewish immigrants who had educated themselves. My father had to go to work when he was 8, child labor. My mother, when she was 14, she took a full-time job as a secretary, knew shorthand and typing. You had to do that. Your family, their families couldn't support them. But they continued to read and to study and to become educated. Education wasn't tied to going to school. You continued to read and to talk about things. So they were very helpful in my departure from high school. Once the truant officer came looking for me, and my mother hid me in the closet. Well, but this is a wonderful thing because I was looking at the other day at some of my compositions, my first compositions when I wasn't quite 14, and they are interesting. They show a strong Russian influence, generalized Russian influence. That's the period of my life I probably composed the most. I composed about 4 hours a day. That's a lot of composing. And by the time I was 16, Henry Cowell saw fit to program one of it's my first performance. It's the Pan American Association of Composers program in 1930, and I was 16 and a half then. So I wasn't just amusing myself, I was working very, very hard. And I was studying with Ruth at the time, and she was a wonderfully appreciative teacher. At that time, I was not in New York. This is the Pan American Association of Composers. I don't know how long it lasted. It wasn't as well known as the ISCM, the International Society for Contemporary Music, or the League of Composers. They were the two principal organizations on the scene in New York. But the Pan American Association of Composers also did vital things. And you see, the program is really very interesting. You look at this program. There's a piece by Petula on it. You know, two Afro-Cuban songs by Caturla, and there's a piece by Anthile, Chavez, Henry Cowell. Imre Weisshaus was a Hungarian who was a piano student of Bartok, and he subsequently changed his name. Do you know the name Paul Arma? You know the name, that's a European name. He became fairly well known in Europe. He changed his name during the resistance. He worked for the resistance, and he in France, and he wanted a name that would be more international than Imre Weisshaus. So that was Imre Weisshaus. Talking about Bartok not teaching piano, Bartok did not teach composition. Excuse me. Let me get this straight. Bartok did not teach composition. When Bartok was living in New York City, must have been the 40s, it was in the 40s, I thought, well, it would be nice to study composition with Bartok. I had studied with Sessions. I thought it would be nice to have some lessons with Bartok. So I dialed the number and called Bela Bartok in the Bronx. he was very nice, and he said, I don't know how to teach composition. I have never taught composition. He spoke very quietly and slowly. And he said, I teach piano, but others maybe can. He said, but I can't teach composition. And I should have gone and taken some piano lessons. And so wouldn't that look lovely on one's resume? Piano with study with Bela Bartok. Besides, I would have met him and it would have been wonderful. But I was studying with another teacher, and I thought it would be disloyal to go to anybody else. So this was a very interesting organization. You can find a lot of this music in the New Music Edition. Have you learned about the New Music Edition? Oh, you're very knowledgeable. Very, very, I'm very impressed. You'll find works by Weisshaus. There's a suite for solo voice there, and there's I think some piano music of Gerald Strang, Henry Brandt's name, you know. Adolf Weiss was the first American 12-tone composer. And I was still in Chicago then studying. Ruth L. Crawford had gone to New York to study with her, she didn't know it then, who was going to be her future husband, with Charles Seeger, to study with Charles Seeger. And she left me a scholarship that she had with her professor, a man, a theorist and composer of the old, really old school. He was the generation of Brahms, not the generation of Brahms, but he must have been a young man during the, he must have been born, no, he was born about 1860 or something like that, 1870 maybe. So he was, and I gave the poor man a hard time because I'd bring in this violent, convulsive, dissonant pieces, and he wouldn't know what to make of them. He says, it's musical, he just didn't understand them. So, and did he try to teach me harmony? I think he tried to teach me harmony too. So I spent that year, that's the year of 1930 to 31, the season 30 to 31, I still was in Chicago. And at that time, one thing, as I told you about that period, there were very few composers in the United States. Now there are hundreds. Somebody told me that about painters, I think there are 30,000 painters, graphic, in New York City. In New York City, an enormous number. There are not 30,000 composers, thank goodness, but there are a lot of them. And I think it's wonderful. I'm not saying the good old days, not at all. I'm just pointing out the difference. These days are much better these times have been much better to me than the old times. The old times were hard. I must have been practically the only avant-garde composer in the Middle West. I guess, maybe, I don't know whether John Becker was known at that time, but I remember, I was very amused. Henry Cowell, I was about 16, he wrote a review in a Spanish, it was a Cuban magazine, actually, of that period. I can let you know about that. But in which he spoke about American music, and he said, he spoke to me as the más interesante composer, the most interesting composer of the Middle West. But I don't think there was anybody else. I couldn't think, but maybe he knew of somebody, but it was very nice. But that's to tell you how few there were, very few. Then, let me see. Now, I came to New York in 1931, and I began to, this was at the depths of the Depression, which is something that's very hard to imagine. We have now, the unfortunate term, homeless people. I didn't dislike this, these names given to groups of people, because suddenly there's a group and they're the homeless. We're not homeless and they're homeless. But anyway, many people that don't have homes. You didn't see that during the Depression, because there wasn't the shortage of housing. The only people that didn't live in apartments or in homes were in New York, were the people who lived in the Bowery, the people with intractable alcoholic problems. But there was housing. But what there was vast and tremendous unemployment. A third of the workforce was unemployed. And this was the thing that was absolutely overwhelming. And you asked me how I made my living when I came to New York. I was 18 years old. My family, Ruth thought I should come to New York, Ruth being Ruth Crawford, and study with her teacher, with Charles Seeger, because there really wasn't anybody for me to study with in Chicago. And so my family put me on a train, and they gave me $50, which was, well, you know, subway fares were a nickel. So that's, how many times? That's 20 times. 20 times 50 is how much? $1,000, right? So that wasn't so little. They didn't say anything, but I wouldn't have, they couldn't support me. I was supposed to support myself. So I was catapulted into New York. The only people I knew were Bruce and Henry Cowell. Henry Cowell was an extremely helpful person in my life and in many other people's lives. He not only was an interesting composer, but he was a nurturing spirit for very many people. While I was still in Chicago, I met him. I knew him as early as the time I was 15 years old. And I would send him my compositions and he would write to me about them, which is, you know, for a busy person, that's wonderful. And it meant a tremendous lot to me. And I remember one of the things he wrote to me was, he said, sent him a song, he said, the tessitura is too low. He thought it was too low. I didn't know what tessitura was. I rushed to the dictionary. I didn't know that I'd been using a tessitura. And so I remember that. But he was wonderfully nurturing and helpful. So I didn't know many people. So there was a problem of how to make a living. So I must have heard through somebody, that there was a position open as a dance accompanist for a dance company called Glucksander, a theater dance company. And so I auditioned by playing at Brahms Rhapsody. And he said, well, have you played for dance before? And I played for one ballet class in Chicago. And I've always made it a habit to be truthful. How truthful, we don't know, but I wouldn't say, so I could say I had played for a dance, right? I had one class. So I was hired. And my first assignment was to play the entire opera of Salome. Not from the score, it was in the piano reduction, but he was doing Salome. And this was plunked in front of me, and I got through it. My years of immersion in contemporary music had served me very well. Strauss didn't seem too difficult. And the other ballets I played the whole score. I used to play the whole score of Petrushka by myself. God knows what I did with it. But then there was an evening-long ballet of Prokofiev called The Prodigal Son. I even got a good review from the paper that was then extant, the Herald Tribune. And so I was being paid 50 cents an hour. So we have to multiply that by 20. It was $20 an hour, wasn't it? And but that would have been fine, but he didn't pay me. I racked up 100 hours with him. That is why I tell him, I said, I have to pay my rent. I absolutely have to. He would give me some money. He wasn't dishonest. He was having a terrible time himself. There were no grants in those days. There was no subsidy. It was a terrific struggle. I don't have any ill feeling toward him whatsoever. And he needed a pianist, and I sort of hung around there. So I got very involved in contemporary dance, and I became the dance pianist for, I ask you, do you know Doris Humphrey and Charles Wideman? You know those names? The great figures, the pioneers of modern dance are Martha Graham, not necessarily in order. Martha Graham, Doris Humphrey, Charles Wideman, Hanya Holm, and that would take in the great, and then later period there was Jose Limon and other people. But the real groundbreakers were actually Martha Graham, Doris Humphrey, and Charles Wideman. So I became their accompanist also, and I supported myself. My parents never gave me any more money. They didn't have any more money to give me. So that was how I got along in the early days. So I figured that all this piano practicing that I did at the age of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 was paid off. It was really worthwhile. So don't forget to practice. And but I was here in 1933, and Ruth Crawford's Study in Mixed Accents, the piano piece. Mm-hmm. I gave the first performance of that. It may not be listed officially, but it was Charles Seeger was giving a series at the New School on contemporary music, and all this was new music, and I learned it and played it for that class. And then a little later on, this is a fascinating program. Again, the Pan American Association of Composers is still alive in 1933, and this was the first performance of Ionization. Which, believe me, we all knew it. We all knew it was an earth-shaking event. I believe it was the first piece entirely for percussion instruments. I don't know of anything earlier. Do you know of anything earlier? Yeah.
It has that reputation.
Yeah, and we knew that it was, you know, a tremendous event. And Slinimski was marvelous. You know, Slinimski is still alive. I think he's 94 or something. He still lectures, and if he were in New York, you would absolutely have to have him. But he's in California. Also, I played these are all first performances. They weren't listed as such, but they were. There was a sonata for violin and piano by Chavez, Oh, then there's a piano study by Strang. Yes, I played that. I forgot about that. And Copeland turned pages for me. And so these are the kind of... Then here's a, also there's a, something by Roldan. You say Roldan?
Amadeus.
Amadeus, Amadeo Roldan, that's right. And then there's... Ruth Crawford did some of her later songs. This is among the last pieces that she wrote, the Sacco Vanzetti piece. So that was the, and then in another, there's a program from the League of Composers. Now the League was considered the more conservative, much more conservative. There was kind of a schism among the composers. You don't have it? The League of Composers program? Do any of you have it? Yeah, any of you have it? Yeah. They were considered the more conservative organization. As a matter of fact, the lines were drawn in a very odd, not, it's not odd. The lines that were drawn were, you were either of the Stravinsky camp at that period, or you were of the Schoenbergian camp. There was no, this was before there was, Copeland developed his Americana style. We'll have to talk about that too. Well, but I was active as a pianist in both camps. And it says here, I played the songs from Das Marienleben, a very, very beautiful work of Hindemith. And it was sung by Ada MacLeish, who was the wife of the poet Archibald MacLeish, eminent. And, but the names there are of a different, they're not the what we call the avant-garde. There's Grunberg, Marion Bauer, Siminsky, it was, and Bloch. The other programs, there was the Young Composers Group. Have you talked about that at all?
No.
Okay. I'll talk to you about the Young Composers Group. This is a group of composers brought together by Copeland. Copeland has always been interested, in younger composers. He's a very, again, a very nurturing kind of person. And he brought together, I think we were seven composers. And we would meet, I think, once a week at his apartment in the Empire Hotel. And we would play music for each other. This was before the days of tapes or recordings. You played your music on the piano, sang if you had to, or went for singing. And all these composers here were members of the Young Composers Group. Bernard Herrmann went on to become a Hollywood film composer. He wrote the film for, what's Orson Welles' most famous film?
Citizen Kane.
The what?
Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane. He wrote the music for Citizen. He went on to Hollywood and wrote the music. And Jerome Ross became, his musical that he wrote was revived recently. I was very interested. He got a long review in the Times. It was called The Golden Apple. The Golden Apple.
Might still be playing.
Yeah, and that's Jerome Ross. He became, and then Israel Sitkowitz was a pupil of Nadia Boulanger and wrote very lovely, well-crafted music, quite French, but not imitative. But he stopped composing about that time. After he came back, he stopped composing. And he had a sort of Proustian personal life. He married first the daughter of the owner of Carnegie Hall, and then he married Lady Guinness, the of the Guinness beer brewery. Yes. She subsequently married Robert Lowell, and when he died, Robert Lowell gave the eulogy at Israel Sitkowitz's funeral. So it was all very cozy. And Lehman Engel became an important figure in American musical theater, very important, particularly as a conductor. He became, I think, the richest of us all. I continued to write music, and after I didn't begin to teach. I was teaching. When did I start to teach? About 1945. I was an adjunct teacher at NYU. Erwin Heilner continued to compose in a rather traditional idiom. Elie Sigmeister became, populist, but this is not to be pejorative. He was very interested in the folk side of American music. He was just this year elected to the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters, which pleased me. Because he stuck to his guns. That was his kind of music, and he had studied composition with Boulanger, you know, knew his craft too. But he was a leftist composer during the 30s. I've got to talk about what happened in the 30s. And then it says Music for a 5 and 10 cent Store by Henry Brandt. It doesn't say Henry Brandt, and I think he left it out on purpose. But this was one of Henry Brandt's wild pieces. He played on pots and pans and things. It was great. Let me just go through. Did we go through all the programs? Yeah, well, there was one private concert at the Program of American Piano Music. This was at a private home of a patron of chamber music. And Copland played his great variations. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about what happened subsequent to 1930-31. I don't know how much research has been done on this. I think it's a very something that has to be studied and examined. What happened to the avant-garde after 1931-32? You know that things began to change enormously. And the Depression had, this is my version of it. And even though you have lived through a particular period in history, it doesn't mean that you understand it fully, not by any means. I lived through the hippie period, I saw the revolt of Columbia. It doesn't mean that you have the total answer to it because you participated in something. But the people stopped writing avant-garde music about 1933. I had some songs published in the music edition, which a lot of people became very, very interested in. They were in my avant-garde style, in a free atonal style. They're not 12 tone. They've been analyzed and lots of things. But that was the last music I wrote. And Varèse stopped composing for about 12 years during this period. He just stopped. The Copland's last avant-garde work, and it's a great piece, are the piano variations. And then he turned to American folk sources. And Cowell stopped writing experimental music. This was a critical juncture in music. I can't help but feel that you no longer could write for a specialized audience. The problems of society were overwhelming, absolutely overwhelming. And in a way that hasn't hit the middle class at all now. It hit the working class, and it hit the middle class in the most extraordinary way. So that many people turned to folk sources. There was a leftist group that Elie Sigmeister and other composers belonged to. Charles Seeger wrote for it under the name of Carl Sands. He even wrote reviews for the Daily Worker under the name of Carl Sands. Understand, none of this is pejorative. I'm just describing what happened. And as for myself, I had begun to study with Roger Sessions. Israel Sitgrutz had decided I needed a thorough classical education. Whether this is a good idea or not, I'm not sure. But I had already published music, I was performing, but some people believe you should have a traditional education, you should have the harmony and the counterpoint. I'm not so sure myself that this is entirely necessary. There must be other alternatives. But anyway, he decided that, and he introduced me to Sessions, who taught me for $5 a month. He gave me one hour private lesson a week, and he said, I hate to take this money, but he did, and I'm glad he did, just because it was better for my morale. So I had a wonderful whole year of wonderful harmony education. And even though my work is primarily contrapuntal, I was never a particular, I'd study about 5 or 6 weeks or 8 weeks of 16th century counterpoint, and I'd stop. That's as far as I could go. But I became a contrapuntal composer nevertheless. So, and my idiom became tonal. I began to write tonal music, which was the first time I had written this. All my other music was atone, very definitely, quite dissonant. Henry Cowell again spoke of my unladylike music, because it was, in those days, because it was so angular and dissonant. And never would I let a C major chord appear on a page of mine. Never. Death first. Even a third, a major third was taboo. It had to be sevenths, ninths, fourths, and combinations of that. But I also modified the way I was writing. It wasn't really these things aren't done consciously. You don't sit down one day say, I'm going to change my style. The whole atmosphere in which you're living, whose influence you're not very conscious. This applies to everything. We're not entirely conscious of the things that influence us. And maybe it's not necessary that we should be. Because if you might become self-conscious about it. So have you talked about this break in the American avant-garde? Well, I do. I don't know who has written. It's really never been studied enough. Ruth Crawford stopped writing. She stopped writing music. And she didn't write another piece until 1953. She became involved in folk music. Now, folk music is wonderful. I'm not saying that it isn't, but the creative urge to do new things was gone. And part of it was the Depression. It was also the leftward movement politically of almost the entire intellectual, and I can believe composers are also intellectuals, of almost the entire intellectual society in the United States. There was a feeling that a drastic solution was needed for the problems of society. And it's very interesting isn't the word, it's mind-boggling for a person like myself who has been through the transition from where the artist went leftward to the events that are happening in Eastern Europe now, where they're moving in the opposite direction. They're moving away from communism. So while there was some of the composers and artists and writers became communists, or else you were very much of a leftist. Another great influence during that period was the Spanish Civil War. This is one of the great tragedies of that that affected all of us enormously. And so this, I don't know why this has not been the subject of some sort of documentation as to what happened there. There were the American composers, I'm trying to think whether I'm trying, anybody else. Now Schoenberg, he was different. We're talking about America. Schoenberg continued to write, you know, develop his 12-tone music and the others, Webern, of course. But I'm trying to think of any American composers who continued to write. Ruggles, I don't know the last state of Ruggles' compositions, but very, very little avant-garde music was being written. So this is worth looking into and studying. The changes in the musical scene have been, you know, they've been, there have been a tremendous number of them in the course of my lifetime. It's very interesting to live through all this. That is, there was the 60s, where unless you wrote notation that was upside down and inside out, you weren't with it. Neoclassicism became a very popular mode of expression in the 40s, but the avant-garde just really ended in 1956. Or 55, Varèse wrote Désert, and this was after, so I think it was 1933, since Zionization. He hadn't written anything, it was 12 years. And then, but there was then again another climate for that. Now, I know I'm going to stop, I think, now and see if you have any questions. That would help me. Then you can go on.
What made Sessions a good harmony teacher?
That's a good question. Yeah, well, Ruth Crawford wasn't, and I didn't have the temerity to teach. I felt I wouldn't be. I think, did I say this to you, Tanya? That it's partly having an analytical mind, a tremendous knowledge of the tradition. Tremendous. People like Boulanger and Sessions, they had the whole thing in their head. They had all the Beethoven quartets and all the Beethoven sonatas and all the Beethoven symphonies and everything else. It was in their head. I can't describe to you how it was. You would ask, you mentioned something of, you know, some middle passage from a quartet session. Says he was a horrible pianist, and he would play it note for note. You know, he would know it. You know, so, and Boulanger too. I've never been able to say that. Thank you for the question, because this is what it is. You have to have the whole thing in your head. And Ruth didn't have that. She had something else in her head. She was an avant-garde composer. And you have to have a belief in that tradition, but mainly you have to you can't just know the harmony exercises. You have to know all the music. And it's an encyclopedic knowledge of the literature. Boulanger, you know, it was frightening to go to a lecture. I mean, she could play anything by heart. And so could Sessions. Once some friends of Sessions, I think it was Israel Sitkowitz and somebody else, they wanted to see, they played a game with Roger and went on for 3 hours. They'd say, play the opening of Opus 101. Play it, you know. Play, you know, the quartets, the symphonies. And he took this as a matter of course. He wasn't the least bit boastful, and he would never have, you know, it never occurred to him to be anything to be proud of at all. He had it. And I think that's the answer, is that they teach not by the rule, all the rules were there, but they teach out of a tremendous musicality which comes from having the music in their head. That puts it as well as I can say, it's the musicality they bring to it. The less good harmony teacher will tell you the rule. With the great teachers, it's you get it sort of by osmosis. You get the musicality by osmosis, because everything they do is referable to something wonderful in music. Thank you for the question. It made me I could formulate what it was. Yes.
I had two questions. One was, did you know other women composers then, and what was the attitude of people toward you as a woman composer in the 30s? That's one question.
All right, can I answer that first? That's a good question, too. I would say it wasn't until about 10 or 15 years ago that I realized what a wonderful influence Ruth Crawford had been for me. Putting it more accurately, how fortunate I was to have her for my teacher. Because I, again, imbibed as a perfectly natural thing the idea that a woman could write bold, interesting music. Never occurred to me that I want to put down these 14-year-old dissonances. That was the way it was going to be, and I was very sure of myself at that time, as you can only be when you're very young. But that's a good kind of sureness to have. So that Ruth was in New York. Ruth was first. And then in New York, I got to know Marion Bauer, who was a lovely person. She wrote much more conservative music. She's a very solid composer, but she wasn't an influence at all. I just knew it. The Young Composers Group, you can see, who was the only woman? I was the only woman there. You were a special case, and maybe one got a little spoiled that way too. But you were always, we would walk into the child's restaurants. There were the very inexpensive restaurants where you'd go after these meetings with Copeland. And there I'd have a retinue of six men, and I was, you know, 18 years old. I liked that. But until very recently, there's been a peculiar attitude about women composers. A friend of mine, a Pulitzer Prize winner and a very nice guy, in 1957 or 56, he heard some orchestration of mine that I'd done of an earlier ballet. And he came up to me and said that I'd like that very much. He said, the orchestration was particularly good. He said, did you do it yourself? And so I said to him, whatever his name was, Jim or whatever. I said, you do yours? And so he realized that. But people were capable of saying such things too. And there is still occasionally in the far reaches of the boondocks where I live, sometimes people will say, think that you compose just songs because you're a woman composer. But I must say the women's movement and the exposure, drawing attention to women composers has been very, very, very good. In those days, there were very few, and they were looked upon as strange ducks, like women surgeons. And so that's the way it was then. It's much better now, much. What was your second question?
Well, the